What's Underneath is a CastBox original produced in partnership with Studio 71.
CastBox is the fastest growing, highest rated podcast app on both iOS and Android, where you can find all of your favorite podcasts.
You can listen to What's Underneath wherever you get your podcasts, but we hope you'll give CastBox a shot and see for yourself.
Hello and welcome to What's Underneath,
the podcast that will inspire radical self-acceptance through empowering you to embrace what's unrepeatable in you.
I'm Lily Mandelbaum, and sitting next to me is my mom, Elisa Goodkind.
And we are Style Like You. In our new podcast, we are going to expand the types of intimate, unfiltered conversations we've been having in our viral video series, The What's Underneath Project.
Each week, we will interview diverse nonconformists about their relationship to style, self-image, and identity.
Being radically honest without shame and holding that honesty with compassion is self-acceptance.
So who are we here with, Mom?
We're here with Domino Kirk, who... we interviewed for What's Underneath 3 years ago, which I can't even believe it's 3 years.
Yeah.
And unconsciously, crazy. I'm wearing a camouflage
jumpsuit.
And I think maybe
it's a
really
good one.
I was channeling Domino, who that's what she was wearing when she did her What's Underneath episode. I was also re-listening to it not too long ago, and it was an incredibly moving moment and interview for us because of her honesty and transformation that she went through, turning her own pain of her own childhood to becoming, as we called her in the video, the title of her video is Mother Supreme, as a doula, as an amazing, amazing doula. And it's just very inspiring always for us when we see people turning pain into beauty. And that's what we're obsessed with. And she's pretty much one of the queens of that, aside from being the mother to all of these people that are giving birth. But, you know, she has a gorgeous 9-year-old who she's an incredible mother too. So we're really excited to be here with her now and to catch back up.
Yeah. And just so you know, it's just a totally organic conversation as per usual, except this time you don't have to get undressed.
It's okay. That's great. I'm really fine with getting undressed with you guys. I could do
it. You could do it again.
Over and over again. Let's just do it.
So how are you feeling today, Domino?
I'm feeling really good. I've been like, it's interesting. I've been dealing with a lot of thyroid issues, a lot of self-care, but not just like in the woo-woo sense, but like really like, wow, I actually have like adrenal, like I have had like an autoimmune disease that has been really crippling, and it's making me think in like the grander scale about how when people give birth they don't ever really come back from it the same. So it's like I can't tell you how many people give birth and then they say, oh, I had postpartum depression and now I'm just sort of always a bit sad and a little bit overweight and like, oh, but that's just after having babies. And I'm now realizing after 10 years of doing this, like I actually had like a broken thyroid and I just dealt with it recently. And I like took medicine and did all the right things, took the herbs, did all the like witchy things that weren't working on their own. And I've been feeling like a different person. It's like a cloud. I was like underwater for 9 years. Yeah. And it's making me go, wow, there are just so many people who give birth and then just settle for this idea of like who they are now. You know, mums are exhausted. Mums are depressed. Mums, you know, become like these one woman shows and like don't know how to communicate to their partner. You know, I have a much deeper understanding now of the postpartum body and like what that really is. And
I wonder why nature does that. I wonder why.
I mean, giving birth can be quite violent, you know, to your environment and to yourself and to to your family. It's like you go through such a radical change. It becomes, if you had like a lover, suddenly it's like a business partner and suddenly you're just, you know, all of the nice things that attracted you to that person are sort of out the window because you need them so much in like a very real way.
Right.
So people are getting divorced by the time the child's two because it wasn't what it used to be, or it wasn't the person I married, or the person I thought, you know, before they had the baby. So it's just But there's so much that I'm realizing, like, if people had more knowledge about, I don't know, just like that level of wellness. Like, sure, we all go back to the midwife or the OB and we get our blood drawn and they say, oh, this looks a little off. But then we don't go back to the doctor for like whoever, you know, who knows how long. So I just have this whole other respect for medicine right now. Because I've always been the one that took the herbs and did the diet because I hate medicine.
Right.
And I'm not, it wasn't working fast enough.
Like, so what were your symptoms and what's helped it?
Well, I mean, I started meditating like 5 years ago and that was really helpful for just overall rage that I grew up with a lot of rage and grew up around a lot of alcohol. So like all I knew was ragey and mood disorders. So I was like, okay, I'll just meditate and I'll just be a better mum because I'm a meditator. And it did help with my moods overall. But the attempting to adjust my adrenal fatigue with herbs, like it just wasn't working. I think it was even making it worse because I was like saying no to all these foods, which felt, I love food. I love eating. I get so much joy from being with people when I eat. I don't drink anymore. So, you know, when I go out and eat, I want to eat everything. Mm-hmm. And like the idea that I couldn't eat anything for
a
while.
Why is that?
Because there's a lot of belief around thyroid that if you know, taking out the grains and taking out all the fun foods to address, you know, so that the body can have more energy. Because to break down all those foods, it wipes your body out.
So you had low thyroid?
I have Hashimoto's, which is like hypo, but next level hypo. Like the doctor read my blood, like got my blood tests back and asked me how I got out of bed in the morning because of how low it was. And I was like, oh, don't all people feel like this with a 5-year-old and a... And when you're divorced and you have five, don't you all feel exhausted and sad all the time? And they're like, no. I had a really, really challenging birth. And I thought, oh, it's because I'm traumatized. Oh, it's because it was obstetrical violence. It was being
what
20.
What violence?
Obstetrical violence.
Oh.
Lots of interventions and lots of ego. I mean, I could talk about that. That's a whole podcast, is the birth of my son. But it was... being 25 and being a sort of alcoholic and like being like, that's why I was sad. And like, I actually didn't think that there was like a physiological thing. I had depression growing up. So I was like kind of used to being in that cozy bubble of depression. I didn't realize that. I think I addressed my thyroid briefly when before my son was one. And then the medicine they prescribed like didn't work. I felt like my hair was falling out. I was still breastfeeding. I felt horrible breastfeeding while taking the medicine. It was like a whole thing. So I just
called. To speed up your thyroid.
Yeah, it was like, let's just take this and sort it out and get back to life. And I was like, nah, I don't want to take medicine. I'm not that mom. And then judging myself so harshly. That's another podcast. I could not.
No, talk about it.
No, it's like to take medicine, to take the help, to take the hand. Like closed mouths don't get fed, right? So it was there I was sort of like, I'm going to just sort of white knuckle this and be like a really good young mom. And like my energy will come back on its own.
There's a lot of shame around taking medicine.
Yeah. And like taking care of yourself and like doing all the things, like eat better, take some herbs. And take the medicine that is proven to work. Then when you're out of the woods, then you can just take ashwagandha and like call it a day. But it's like with antidepressants, that huge stigma around like, I should be happy. It's not natural to take this medicine, but it's also not natural to be depressed.
Right.
You know, like on that level. So when I have friends or clients who are like, oh, I take Prozac or I'm on. I'm like, so what?
Right.
Great. You wouldn't wash a dish without detergent. Like, you know, it's like you need it. And then, I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes you need that like kick. Like
something.
Sometimes
just
you need
to,
it.
To
sometimes
get,
you
and
need
then
it.
You can coast, you know, after you've gotten over that hump.
Right.
And for me, like being on call for women for nearly 10 years, waking up at 3 a.m. and like not knowing what time I was going back to bed, like really zapped my body.
That is very stressful, actually.
Yeah. And just like never really knowing like how long I'd be gone and then how my own child might suffer while I was gone. And that was really intense. And it was my job. So I actually like didn't think about it. I just went to work, you know, until I started to really feel it in my body. Like the meditation, as I was saying, really helped my mental health, but my body was like dragging, you know. And I actually had 2 miscarriages in last year after I got married. And I chalked it up to like not being ready and like all these woo-woo things, like, you know. But then the doctor was like, no, your thyroid is broken and that's why your body can't hold babies. And I was like, oh, shit. Okay. And I sort of paused and was like, miscarriage, really normal. I've supported so many people through miscarriage. I've been there, you know, as like I've said before with you guys, I've been there for stillborn babies. Miscarriage for me is like, oh yeah, me too. Like it's a real thing in my world. So it was easy to deal with the miscarriage, but it wasn't easy to understand and accept that it was my body that was sort of tired and like incapable of holding these babies. That was the kick in the pants that I got and really made me go, okay, I'm taking this medicine.
Why do you think it's so hard in this culture? I don't know, the self-care, like what's the fear of just kind of needing help? Or, you know, what?
I think it's just, there's this part of our brain or ourself that feels like we should just be able to do it on our own, and like we have this like built-in system that knows how to get back on our feet. And like I mean, for me, I have 2 categories. I have like the survival skills that I learned how to get by in my family. Like I know how to get through a day, but I didn't know how to live well. That was really, those two were very different for me. Like I know how to struggle and to just make it by the skin of my teeth, emotionally, in love. Everything was just like struggle and then like victory and then struggle and then victory. And I didn't know how to just like be okay all the time, you know? And I think when you grow up, what I've heard learned from people who grew up similarly to me is that when you're, environment is so unpredictable and you never know what mood someone's going to be in and you're always waiting for some sort of bomb to drop, like you have sort of no choice, at least when you're younger, to just sort of recreate that. And so I think people, I mean, for me, like taking care of myself was like not drinking for 3 days, you know, and like, or it was not eating like greasy food, or, you know, but that deeper feeling, that deeper understanding of like what it meant to take care of my whole self was like completely foreign to me until I actually stopped drinking, like fully. And I wasn't like a diehard alcoholic, like blackout, but I would drink to socialize. I didn't know how to hang out with people and look in their eyes unless I had at least one drink in me.
When did you stop?
5 years ago.
You were saying that that there was the struggle, and then and you knew how to survive that struggle, but you didn't know how to find the balance.
Yeah, and, I think the struggle growing up with them. Well, what happened was I just ended up feeling like the adult all the time because I was a naturally like pretty sensible person, and like I feel like once I got older and I realized that my parents were just like tall children, I was like, oh, wow, I don't feel safe. And shit, I have never felt safe with you. Like in that way that where I can relax. I struggled to relax as a kid. I didn't sleep in. I never missed school because I had a fever. Like nothing. Like if I had a fever, I was going to school. Like there was no... I don't have memories growing up of being in a household where there wasn't 1,001 things going on. And I look back and I'm like, my parents were in a really, in a marriage that was much more superficial than I wanted to believe. Like they loved each other and they were drawn like hot for each other, but they didn't really like know each other. And they had kids sort of in a hurry. And like the foundation of my childhood was extremely rocky. But I had lots of siblings, so we sort of leaned into each other. And I had a nanny who was a young Welsh woman who was my touchstone. But I knew she wasn't my relative. So I was like, there's a person in this house who cares about me, I think, a little bit more than my own mother, because she's picking me up from school. She's bathing me. She's making my meals. And my mom's like in her office somewhere. You know, I was like, this is confusing. Mm-hmm. So I think I just got lots of mixed messages. So by the time I was like out of the house, I only knew how to like just like take the temperature of everyone all the time. I like never knew how to just relax and like live. It was always like, okay, who's this person and what are they doing? And, you know, it was just trust issues. I like didn't trust anyone to take care of me. So I was always the one taking care. And then having a child at that age, I think, was just more about like, I'm going to be able to do this better than you guys. A little bit like I had to prove something, and also had all these other feelings about his father, and our child was just like so strong. It was like so meant to be. But once he was here, like all my issues around not being mothered very well and like what it means to have like a functioning family, like all that stuff came out in the wash.
Right away.
Yeah, it was even happening in labor.
That's so fascinating. You touched on that in the What's Underneath video. Mm-hmm. And I think you were talking about how in labor and in pregnancy, everything comes out. And me coming from the olden days at this point, because I'm 60, we didn't even think about anything like that. So, yeah. I mean, the idea that in your pregnancy and in your labor, you're actually transmitting all of your trauma. You talked about that. I think that's a great thing for people to hear about.
If you're a birth attendant or in birth work at all, it's like, that's sort of what we live by. Like the whole idea or the mantra for me is that people birth how they live. So if someone has had sexual abuse or any history of substance or crazy, you know, family upbringing, whatever it is, like there's no way they can avoid that in their labor unless they run to the hospital and slap that epidural in their back and just lay in bed and read an Us magazine. Like basically they're not going to get away with anything. I've been to, you know, hundreds of births at this point, and I honestly can't think of one labor where if I knew they had any abuse history that the labor wasn't somehow reflecting that.
How was it reflecting it for you?
People asking for parents, saying, you know, mummy, and like being like really like true digression, long labors where they last way longer and their bodies are not progressing or opening, a lot of holding. We know how to hold trauma in our bodies. Like it's not good for us, but we all do it on some level. And in labor, if you're holding, you're actually going to hold your baby in. Like, it's amazing. I've seen people be right about to push their children out into the world and stop their labor with their heads. It's fascinating.
Wow.
Like, you know, and sometimes I know, like I said, when we did our episode together, like I know maybe sometimes if they've had an event or a thing, that if they're talking about it, but sometimes people don't tell me anything. Like, and they won't open their legs when they push their baby out. And I'm like, okay, I just got chills to my ankles. You have been, you know, abused or assaulted in some way. You will not, you know, you don't like it when people come from behind. You don't like it when people say certain things. You don't like it when a man comes in the room that is a resident and you've never seen him before. Some people are like, fine, just get the baby out of me. And some people are like, they are managing everything in the room. For me, it was holding. It was laboring for days and days, not feeling quite safe with my birth team. I had chosen a midwife that reminded me of my mum, so it didn't go very well. But I also was really drawn to like really like hot-headed and like ferocious, sort of unstable powerhouse women back then. Like I had lots of older women friends who were weirdly competitive with me and like jealous of me or like God, who knows what, but just had like stuff going on underneath. It wasn't an overt loving friendship. I had tons of those friends back then. And then I picked the midwife that had the biggest ego, basically. I mean, I love her and I've been a doula for her since I've given birth with her. But I picked her based on her ego. I knew meeting this midwife that it was going to be challenging because she was reminding me so much of my mom. But I picked her anyway.
So with your own personal journey to, so that's like, there's the struggle and how you learn to be in the struggle and to overcome each thing and kind of, okay, made it, and mm-hmm. then feeling unsafe in the world. And then how have you learned to, what's been the process of surrendering and trying to be more at peace with the universe and understanding, I mean, that the world is actually safe and
yeah, all that's, of that? It's been a journey. I mean, it's like, I think age is real, like aging and time takes time, right? So it's sort of like, okay, it's been a while. I like being a victim and constantly telling like stories of my childhood in my head to validate things I was doing or not doing. Like that got really old.
Meaning like, oh, it's okay, I can drink because I had a hard childhood.
Yeah, I had a hard childhood. No one paid attention. I was molested. Mm-hmm. All these your things. Story. Like, yeah. Here's my story. So bad. So horrible. Oh my God, I can't believe that happened to you. I know. Isn't it terrible? Drink. Mm-hmm. Sex everywhere. Sex with everyone. And like losing, like not knowing, you know, who that person was because it was in the story. And I definitely went to Al-Anon meetings and adult children of alcoholics meetings. 12-step meetings helped me a lot. I really liked the community around it. It really helped me build trust in people again. A lot more trust in things that I couldn't see. Mm-hmm. I was so attached to like the stories and the people and nostalgia. I was a deeply nostalgic person, always in fantasy. But I always had like, I had a very rich fantasy life as kids do. But mine, I think, went a little further with it because my environment was so, I had to. So I have like vivid memories of like creeping out onto my fire escape and imagining like someone would just come get me, you know, like, and sitting there and waiting for them. Like, and I remember being as young as like 5 and packing a bag and putting it under my bed and, you know, waiting just in case the house burnt down. You know, like I was a vet. I remember getting in a car once and we nearly hit another car and we swerved off the road and everyone like took a deep breath and like got on with the drive and I imagined us dying. Like I was a very sort of morbid kid that always saw like the worst case scenario because I think I was really seeing the worst in people, you know.
Or the truth.
Or the truth. I don't know. I mean, I was like, oh, God, if
you
that's
were saying the truth and you were young. It was too much.
It was too much. Yeah. It wasn't. No one was sort of like
taking care of your needs.
Yeah. Not really.
You had to be the parent.
But I think it's generational, too. I really do. Like my parents grew up in the 50s with drunks as their, you know, way worse alcoholism and, you know, workaholism than me. I think kids back then were just a detail, you know. I mean, I think my dad was like locked in a cupboard so his parents could go to the pub. I mean, like, I mean, that was okay. So I have a lot more compassion when I hear these stories because I'm like, you actually have no idea how to be a parent. And you figured it out as you went along and so did I. And I think we all do.
So have you been able, what is the forgiving part of all of this? Like, where are you with all of that? And like, what does that look like? Because
I have less expectation. I think what was killing me was that I was wishing that my parents could have been different. I was wishing that my son's father could have been like these ideas of who these people could be if they would only ... I stopped that and then I just started, I mean, Al-Anon and all these groups that help you deal with people who are addicted to substance, like they helped a lot because I think when someone's that detached or hungover or that checked out, like if you're their friend or their lover or their sibling, like you spend a lot of your time wishing they were present. You're like, oh, I just wish you weren't fucking hungover right now. Like then we could actually talk. And like, I had that, but before I knew what it was. So it's like, I think what happened more recently was just accepting people for where they were exactly mm-hmm. in that moment. A lot more acceptance, like radical acceptance of people and really loving them for where they were and not pushing my agenda on on them. Mm-hmm. I think what I realized along the way is that I was always very codependent, always healing and helping and fixing, and that gave me power. But I realized somewhere along the way that, like, being that person or posing as like a healer or
taking care of everyone,
that's not being a loving person. There's a huge difference between being like a healer or a guru. I actually cringe when people say they're healers. I cringe.
Me too.
Like, it's just all...
What does that mean?
I don't know. I always...
And who are you? I'm always like, what's your life like? And what are you... Whenever you dig deep with these people. Right. Like, yeah.
And so I just...
Epitomized by Wild Wild Country. Have you seen that?
No, not yet. I don't watch telly. I have to watch more TV.
You got to watch that one because that's like the epitome of it all.
Oh my God. It's about the culty. That's really what shifted, is I just stopped feeling high off of that, being that person for people. And I think that really, and people changed. People started feeling more relaxed around me because I wasn't little Judge Judy walking around everywhere being like, oh, you could do that a bit better. And we could be closer if, and you know, and people feel
you were being
that.
Conditional yourself.
Tension. It's, you're not just like, hey.
And how do you feel that that mirrored your own acceptance and your own relaxation within yourself?
Well, it helped me understand that if I was suddenly really addressing all of these issues in my social life or in my love life or in my family, like they say, I think in Al-Anon, at least, you know, or those groups, it's like you come in here with all these stories and all of the, a lot of blaming and a lot of victimizing and martyrdom and all the rest of it. But you end up realizing that the person in there that you should be forgiving first, who was the worst person to you, was you.
Changes everything.
I'm my biggest qualifier. I'm the person that, you know, was the meanest to myself, you know. And I think from there, anything's possible. So that was really what changed. I mean, initially getting that kind of help and learning about self-care, quote unquote, like I would just go into these meetings and just sort of complain about people and, you know, toot my own horn a lot. Sit and cry for like hours.
Where do you think
be that person crying in the corner the whole meeting and be like,
where does the meanness to oneself, that beating oneself up like that, why does that happen? Like, what is that coming from exactly? Like,
I grew up with lots of sisters, and I grew up with a lot of, there was a lot of competition in my family. And I think I was just very hard on myself because whether my mom meant to or not, I was pitted against my siblings a lot, and even my brother too. Like, we were all sort of, I feel like in families, everyone's assigned, you're going to do this and you're going to do that and you're going to fuck it up and you're going to bail her out and then you're going to do better and you're going to be more beautiful and you're, you know, and it's like everyone's being handed scripts, I feel like, in big families at least. I mean, my husband,
I think all families.
Yeah, all families. Like, my husband's an only child, and, you know, he explains, you know, he says similar things, and I'm always like, oh no, it's because I had all these siblings and it was a shit storm. He's like, no, I was alone and it was the same. So yeah, in all families, I feel like you're sort of assigned your roles and you're supposed to play them out, and often, you know, I feel like we get pretty far with them and then we see them not working. And
Like, it's like you take on this role to survive this.
Yeah.
Difficult situation. It was a survival tactic, and then the survival tactic becomes sort of closes in on you as an adult.
Yeah, I'm still nine, and
yeah, run away from these things. It doesn't matter you move to.
Yeah, and I think that I was very hard on myself because it was just I didn't get a lot of nurturing. I didn't get a lot of, like...
You didn't know how, going back to what we were saying, how to take care of yourself.
I didn't learn how to do that. I just sort of, you know, I didn't have like hand-holding, you know, eye-to-eye, knee-to-knee experience with my parents. So I didn't have anyone really signing off on anything I did. I was just very critical and very hard on myself because
not feeling enough.
Like, yeah, because it was just me and myself and me judging, and not, I didn't have a parent saying, no, that's great, well done you. Like, mm-hmm. it was just sort of like, oh, I think I could be better, I could be thinner, or I could be more this or more that. Like,
and then maybe I'll get the love.
And then I'll get the love. Mm-hmm. In my family, it was a lot of physical growing up and a lot of about appearances. And then more when I got older, it was about career. And I just always stayed the course, though. Like, I struggled through it, but I always did what I felt, ultimately.
Your own course.
Yeah, like, being a doula wasn't my family's plan for me. They always saw me doing this other thing, and I just kept going where I was headed, and I had a lot of kickback from my family. But yeah, it's funny. Now I see them, and I do see them as children, and I do accept them all a lot more. My parents specifically, I don't have as much anger. And I think overall there's just a lot more peace than ever, because I accept that they didn't really know what they were doing.
Have you always been like so comfortable being so open about
these things? Yeah. I think I've always been very just like, I just like put it all on the table. Even when I was, you know, I was the one that people told everything to.
Like, do you speak honestly with your parents about these sorts of things?
I do and I don't, because you have to be careful, right? Because I'm not trying to punish mm-hmm. like people for being who they were. I think my mom has made so much, you know, she's made such an effort to look at this stuff. Losing her parents, of course, it all came out in the wash for her. Like, she's in her own process, you know, and like, I think I'm getting much better at not, you know, just not blaming and knowing myself, like having more boundaries. Like, when you hang out mm-hmm. with that person that makes you crazy, whether it's your mom or your ex, or, and you have to see them every day or however much, I just know that after like 2 hours, I gotta leave. Mm-hmm. You know, you just start mm-hmm. knowing how to be. It's not that black or white thing anymore. Mm-hmm. I used mm-hmm. to be very, like, I have friends and family, I have friends and people in my family who really believe in just that. Like, if that person isn't serving you, they have to be out. And, like, not talking to family for years on end. And, like, it doesn't help, though. It just, it lives in you. And I don't know, maybe birth has, like, taught me that more than anything.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Just watching the process of giving birth, of the pregnancy journey and giving birth is just like nothing. We are all just like storehouses, like storage units, you know. It's like,
and meaning that, like, so, you can't, even if you don't speak to your family, it's not like you're just like, good, oh, like they're gone.
Like people who are like, oh no, I don't talk to that person. We don't talk. I moved when I was, okay, cool. And then when they're in labor, they're asking for that parent. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like,
there's no really disconnecting from those situations.
It's like all that pain, tentacles. Yeah. It's all like these invisible, like,
right. We're all connected. Know. We are literally, literally connected to each other. Like, literally.
Yeah.
But also, like, you can't think that type of like fundamental, like, pain and yearning and desire mm-hmm. for like a parent mm-hmm. is ever going to like go away. Even if you like recognize that your parents like mm-hmm. weren't what they could have been or didn't provide as much love as they could have. Like, I think probably it's more beneficial to just accept that that's a pain you're going to have in your heart forever mm-hmm. than to like try to like get rid of it.
Because once you see it for what it is and you accept that mm-hmm. it's there, there's so much that can be done with it. Mm-hmm. It's just that sort of like, oh, I don't want to have this. You know, mm-hmm. that like, oh, get rid of it, resisting it and the fight around it mm-hmm. that makes it crazy, or the fact, you know, overthinking it and mm-hmm. just let it be there. You know, I feel like mm-hmm. that's my biggest thing now is, I mean, meditation is big, you know, any kind of meditation, whatever you're doing, however you're doing it. You know, the whole thing is just not attaching to the thoughts and the feelings and the memories that come up when you're sitting there for mm-hmm. however long. And I think if you can have that as like a living breathing, that's like a living meditation. Like, the goal is to be in like a state of that, right? I think mm-hmm. at least that's how I try to be. And I don't think I could have been in this sort of clearing I'm in now if I kept drinking, even if I wasn't like a day in, day out drinker. Even getting lost once a week and leaving my body once every, you know, once a month or whatever it was, like, that was affecting the way I who I was in the world, like mm-hmm. who I presented in the world. And like, and also every time I would complain about someone, it was because of their substance abuse. So there I was complaining about everyone, but then I was getting drunk myself. So it didn't, mm-hmm. it was like, how can you talk about your abusive childhood and all your drunk, you know, drug addicted family and still take drugs and still drink? Like, mm-hmm. no, it's not matching.
If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please subscribe and give us a good rating so the powers that be can keep this podcast going.
So was it a hard process for you to like become sober? And
it was, so once I was like, oh wow, life is so much easier right now, like not doing this.
Why? How so?
I just like who I am more. I just prefer, it's easier to sift out like the people who are really I guess the people who are really in your corner from the ones that aren't. I have less friends. I'm nowhere near as cool in that way. Like, I don't go to the things I'm invited to. Like, not because I'm like better than anyone. It's just that I know that I won't be able, like, it's just not going to be a great situation for me if I go to that thing or that party or that thing. You know, I was very recently invited to a party that would have been really fun in like the old days, but it still would have been fun. But I think I've started to pay attention to the way I feel when I leave places. So it's like, if I go to that place and I see that person and I feel worse than when I went in, then maybe that's not working. Like, mm-hmm. whatever that is. And often these parties or these things I get invited to, I don't feel better when I leave, you know? And I don't know what that's about. Is it me like judging everyone like crazy while I'm there? Or is it because that those people aren't really considering me, that that's not real? No one's teaching mm-hmm. me anything.
Seeing I'm you not, for who you are or yeah. accepting you for who you are. I don't think people realize what alcohol or drug addiction really is. Like, they think when it's couched, because I think that it's more what's around it mm-hmm. in some ways, or as much what's around it as the actual thing. Mm-hmm. So they think, well, I'm not that. I'm not dropping down drunk every day, but I'm running at 5 o'clock and I can't make a plan for anything else because I have to have, you know, or, you know, I think there's things around addiction.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I could get together with a bunch of moms and have a bottle of wine and no one would bat an eyelid. But I was going home to my kid drunk. I was like buzzed with my 1-year-old and then breastfeeding him.
Right.
And then feeling shit and being like, why do I feel so shit? I just had a bottle of wine. Everyone drinks wine.
There's so much addiction.
I would pump and dump, by the way, just so you know. I didn't breastfeed with, you know, alcohol in my system.
Well, I just think that there's so much, like so much of addiction is not, there's so much shame around it. And there's so much, and it's couched in these rituals and ceremonies mm-hmm. kind of that we do every day, social things or whatever. But in actuality, it's addiction. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, and then I think a lot of kids that are growing up in that then think it's okay too, mm-hmm. because they don't see it as addiction because it's couched in these rituals. And do you agree with that?
I grew up in a party house. So the kids were upstairs asleep while the adults had fun downstairs. And like, I have a vivid memory of falling asleep always to the hum of a crowded living room. You know, like that actually helped me fall asleep. So I was like, oh, my house is full and I feel safe. But what made me feel safe was feeling very unsafe, I guess. It was just like, oh, this is familiar. Like, so being out at night, being in parties, like going to these events and like, I don't know. It was just, yeah, it was mm-hmm. the ritual of it.
There's a familiarity and you were, I think a lot of us are unconscious of some of these, of things that we do, addictions that we do that are familiar, that are things that we're drawn to that aren't good for us because mm-hmm. they were things from the past that are attracting us to yes. it, but you don't really realize that you're doing that.
No. And it's, I think yeah. you just end up like if you're uncomfortable, my friend said, if you're uncomfortable, you're headed in the right direction. Like, it's like, I've been so uncomfortable being married. I hate marriage. I'm bored by it. I'm like, ugh, this person every day, same thing over and over again. Like,
you just got married.
I just got married. So it's
for the
like
second or first?
First time. I wasn't married to my son's father, but I getting married, just taking that leap of faith and believing that there was something in that arrangement that was going to be healing for me and actually like a good thing for my son, even though I actively co-parent, it's still like creating this foundation that maybe I didn't get. And I think when we grow up in like dysfunction, there's like loyalty to it. You know, you want to like, it's like the mafia, like you don't want to like tell on it. You're not like, that was bad and I'm going to do better. You sort of just want to like carry the torch.
Keep participating in the drama.
Yeah. And so I've been like deeply uncomfortable for 5 years of just being, getting healthier and healthier and healthier and feeling it and being like, I hate this. I hate it. I just want really uncomfortable. I want to feel comfortable again. I want to be with the person I know I can take care of. I want to like get a little tipsy and maybe like text someone that is from my past because they will write back. And like, you know, just like let me just like feel a little bit bad. Like I hate feeling like pure and open and like not hungover or like not any, you know, it's not hungover.
Safe with someone just, married to someone who wants safe. To be married to. Yeah.
Oh, someone who you don't have to take care of or you're not worried is having an affair with your friend or is on tour or like drinking to like maybe like dead in a ditch somewhere. Like, I mean, this was me in my early 20s. And so granted, like it's not who that person is anymore and who I am anymore. But then like I definitely grew up with some, my mom was constantly wondering where my dad was. And I definitely had like low level suspicion in my house all mm-hmm. the time. Mm-hmm. Like you were always sort of like hairy eyeballing everyone. It's very weird feeling to not wonder if that person is telling the truth and just to be like, oh yeah, I actually just trust everything you just said. Whoa.
Well, it's like, isn't it what you're saying that in a way we like, we're normalizing this like bad behavior and mm-hmm. like, and then getting, and then growth away from it, the growth and the healing is uncomfortable.
It's yeah. so uncomfortable.
I really relate to that.
When I was younger was always really urgent. Like if it was, and my friend also told me this wise woman who I really see as sort of like a mentor, that she said, if it's urgent, it's not important. To people who grew up in alcoholic homes, it's like, okay, is everyone safe? Is anyone dying? No one's dying. Everyone's safe. Okay, fine. It's like always like ready to pounce. And if that is happening for me now, if I feel like something's urgent, I got to talk to someone, I got to be somewhere, I don't do anything. Because I really...
You're panicking.
Yeah, like being in a state of like high panic and anxiety is really normal for me.
Catastrophizing, the world's falling apart.
Well, if you feel safe, it's like fight or flight is
fight
like
or flight
comfortable.
Is so comfy.
Because you're needed and you like to be needed and solving problems. Yep. And like, so something being calm and like peaceful.
Calm and peaceful safe. And loving. Mm-hmm. I just, those things, those things happen for and to everyone else but me.
With your career and mm-hmm. being a doula and like having this very unpredictable and intense schedule and like where you have to give everything.
Yeah.
How are you like dealing with that as you're coming into like this chapter of wanting to take care,
well,
better
I actually
care
got,
of yourself?
I'm not on call anymore. I took myself off call to really take care of my adrenal stuff, which was starting to be really, really bad.
Meaning like, so your other doulas that you've like, your community is on call.
I'm teaching a lot. I'm training doulas and I'm expanding Carriage House. Mm-hmm. But I'm not personally on call anymore. And it's the first time in 9 years that I haven't been on call. And so that's huge for me too. It's sort of like, oh, wow, like I can make a plan and not fear that I'm going to disappoint someone. And oh my God, like this is the biggest act of self-care that I've ever given myself. It's like actually like taking myself out of the ring. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, my work is that I don't have to be on call right now. And that's great in terms of just like financially supporting myself. Carriage House birth is at a point where we can just sort of coast a little. And so I'm just really enjoying it. And I would never in the past have given myself permission to do that, you mm-hmm. know. It's like go, and the busying of keeping myself that busy was all I knew how to do. Mm-hmm.
How is it feeling to
not be needed that urgently?
Yeah, and also to not give yourself that space.
Anytime I see a pregnant person, I'm like, oh, do you have a doula? Like, because there's a part of me that wants to just like engage and maybe I'll take a few clients, like no big deal. And then I'll be with my husband or a friend of mine who will say, Domino, you're not on call. Like, why are you talking to these people about? And I'm glad now that I have an agency because I can get everyone doulas and they don't have to be me. Mm-hmm. So it's been really nice. But I see it in myself. It's like a little voice that comes up in me that says, like, you're too relaxed. You have too much time on your hands. You know, it's really crazy. It's like,
are you feeling better?
Oh my God. It's like night and day. Like, I had no idea what I had put myself in. As much as I loved my work, I was at the mercy and sort of bleeding for like people constantly. And it really, I just was replicating, you know, what it felt like to grow up the way I did. But
being the mother, the nurturer, the taking care of everything, the oldest in the oldest, yeah, right?
Oldest girl. I think just being on, I don't know, like just being on call. What I mean, I have a lot of friends who are like labor and delivery nurses. And if I sit with them long enough or have a coffee with them, we all grew up similarly. You know, being at the ready. In the doula training that Carriage House offers, we're really talking about boundary setting and not telling your story. And when you're meeting these complete strangers and you're holding such crazy space for these people, like, know who you are in that. Because it is sacred space. It is life and death. And if you're in there just like projecting your stuff onto these people, or if you're giving too much, like, what are you taking away from your own life? So I love our doula training because it's very inclusive and very current and very holistic and really focuses on like the doula, who is that person, you know?
What's been a high moment in your work, like a moment, like what's,
I think honestly, training doulas has been the best feeling of my whole career because it's giving back in a way that I didn't think I was gonna ever be able to do. Like when I became a doula, it was very lonely. Like I got all these tools and tricks, and then I was just told to like go out in the world and be a doula, and I had no idea how challenging it would be and how lonely it would be.
It sounds so kind of romantic and sort of wonderful.
Yeah, you feel like a superhero, but then you come home and you're like, whoa, I just witnessed some crazy, like, violent acts, and I can, you know, I'm really intuitive, as we all are, and, like, you know, I just felt all this drama in this family, and, like, oh, my God, I have to, like, carry this home with me, and, like, I think for so long I wondered when I was going to be able to, like, share all the tips and the tricks that I'd learned to like bring myself back. Because if you do that sort of work too long and you don't know how to connect back, you will burn out, you know, it'll seep into your relationships in a big way. Like, because you have nothing to give. You're tapped.
Does it ever feel kind of thankless? Do you ever walk away and feel, okay, I'm really not part of this, really?
Or? It's funny. I do go through that. I think anyone in that, like the service world, like on any level, really, I'll definitely see people I've been the doula for. And I personally won't remember like maybe the parents' names, but I remember their birth or, because all I'm really doing is holding space, right? So it's not like I'm their best friend. That I have really good boundaries now. So I am providing a job where they could just shake my hand and say thank you and goodbye. And like, but I think when I was younger as a doula, I wanted them to think, to like embrace me. And I was like their doula and they'll talk about me until the kid is, you know, I'll be that, the story they'll tell their kid about me when the kid is grown or something. Mm-hmm. but like, that was a lot of ego as well. That's a lot of me just like tooting my own horn. Like really, I'm a doula. I help them get their kids earthside and then I am done. Mm-hmm. You know, and like I've been there for lots of people who have said, oh, I think, yeah, we had a doula. I don't remember her name. I'm like, I'm sure lots of, my name's pretty memorable, but like, you know, I'm sure for people, I'm just someone who helped them one day or 4 days or whatever it was.
What do you think is the biggest risk you've ever taken in your life?
Having a kid. Honestly, just like feeling so ill prepared, but so trusting of something higher that would take care of it all, like fully knowing consciously that I was like completely ill equipped and that me and his dad weren't in places to really do that. that was, but doing it anyway. Yeah, that was it. Just becoming a mom.
Do you still feel like it's a risk, or do you still feel like you're ill-equipped, or how do you feel now?
Sort of. I'm learning a lot more how to be in relationships in general. So it's like I have a better relationship. I had this very over exaggerated idea of what a mother should be, because I think I had I didn't have that. So over years of wanting it, I wanted Mother Supreme, but I never got Mother Supreme. So I was like, okay, I have to be Mother Supreme. And like now I think I'm just a lot more forgiving with myself. And I talk to my son a lot about when I'm like doing something wrong or screw up. I'm like, oh my God, I'm having such a bad day. I'm so sorry. And he's like, oh, you're so, we talk in this way where I hope he feels respected and heard. And I don't, cause I didn't, no one ever asked me how I felt about something growing up. Mm-hmm. I ask him constantly, how did you feel about that? And he's like, I don't know, you know, he like brushes me off a lot because he's 9 and like basically going on 18 and has more testosterone in his body than like most people, I think. Mm-hmm. But he's very like, I consider him. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, that's a really big deal for me, or that's a big realization. I'm like, wow, and I might not be the best mom and I might not see him every day, but when I'm with him, I really consider him. Mm-hmm. And also like practicing this, marriage has taught me this, but also just like, I don't know, getting older has taught me a lot about like, I can't expect people to, if I'm not giving something that I want, you know, whether it's like being a really patient mother or a really good wife who, you know, is playful and fun loving and helpful and like, if I'm not doing those things, I can't expect them to be given back to me. Mm-hmm. And that's been really key for me to like have healthy relationships in general, friendships or not, or whatever. It's just like, if you're not giving the thing you want, you will not get it. And that's like become just like my, like I go from that point. Mm-hmm. That's the baseline for all for my life right now.
What would you say is your biggest source of shame?
I have a lot of shame about not staying with my son's father. I have a lot of shame about breaking the unit, but I also, you know, I feel like there's a lot of sort of old fashioned, these ideas that like children need to have the mom and the dad and mm-hmm. like the thing. I actually have a very loving arrangement with his dad, but you know, late at night, I'll sort of wish that we were older and wiser and could have figured that out. Because there is so much love there and we were young and drunk and, there was a lot of acting out, you know? So I think the shame, but also like my parents stayed together their whole marriage, you know, since till we were grown and, it was miserable because mm-hmm. I could feel how little they knew each other and how much they really didn't like or trust each other. And that might have been a bit more damaging than anything. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like the most loving thing I could have done with his dad was leave him, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And cause I was a really reactive person and a really controlling person. And he's a very, very, you know, he's a rambling spirit and you can't contain those people. Mm-hmm. So I think by leaving was just sort of like, hey, I accept you, you know, mm-hmm. and I accept you for who you are and how you're going to live and trust you with our child. And like, so I think it's like, oh, that's as loving as it's going to get. Mm-hmm. And if we had done the like, the happy home thing, I don't know how happy it would have been, mm-hmm. but it definitely haunts me for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm.
What are you most afraid of?
I think I'm the most afraid of ever going back to being not present. That like all the work I've done to sort of raise the bar for myself. If I slipped or if I delved back into something that would take me away from this space or like away from my son. and staying in that place, like that scares me a lot. Like, I really have high hopes for this chapter of my life, and like I really want to do everything I can to keep that ball in the air and be the person that I think my son deserves. Is like, it definitely, it's like, it does sort of rule my life in a way, because I just really want to be like a safe house and a touchstone for him. So I've just worry about, I'm fearful of drama. I hate drama now. So I'm like, whenever drama's, if I can smell drama, I'm like, huh. Because what I'm trying to create is something so the opposite. So yeah.
If you could say anything to the little girl who was like sitting on the balcony imagining, what were you imagining?
I was just hoping that someone was just going to come and get me. I don't know who, I would have gone with anyone.
What would you say to her?
I would just tell her to be patient and to hang in there. I honestly, like, this whole being in your mid-30s thing is very, I love it so much. And like, I know it's like there's a chemical component, there's a hormonal component. I'm really enjoying being in my 30s. If I met me then, I would say, I promise you it gets better, and here's my number, and let's meet up, because you're going to want to know me.
What does self-acceptance mean to you?
Guys. What does self-acceptance? For me, it means being entirely present. Like, it means being, you know, I think I spend a lot of time like remembering who I was when I was 19, remembering my 20s, you know, and like that, it, even in all that nostalgia, I don't feel, it doesn't feel good, because I'm not just like being with myself now. So I do notice that I'm not that accepting of myself when I'm, even when I'm just walking down the street, remembering a person from my, you know, like, I think self-acceptance for me is doing everything I can to stay in the moment. Yeah. And sometimes, like you asked me earlier about shame, and I think sometimes the shame that creeps up on me is really like, why did it take so long for me to get it? Like, ugh, wasted so much time being so antsy and not being able to sit still. I mean, my son's father always said to me, you don't know how to do nothing. I'd be like, yeah, because there's so much to do. We have a child, and he was like, oh my God. But a lot of, it's not just him, like I've had many people over the years say that you don't know how to stop, and you're insatiable. And it's been really it's been really amazing to feel what they were talking about.
Well, to me, you're really young doing it, and you're really lucky from my vantage point, because it's taken me twice as long. It's never too late.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Domino. That was so amazing. Welcome. Thank
this
you very
wonderful.
Much.
Good to be back. Such a treat for us. Yes. Such an honor and a treat.
Yeah. Yay. And I can't stop staring at your the white eyelet with the tattoos. The combo of the eyelet.
I know it is.
And the tattoos.
That shirt. I'm just like, where did you get that shirt?
It's at the flea market. I don't know.
It's perfect. So amazing.
It's perfect. It is a fantasy world in and of itself, that shirt.
But with the tattoos. It's the eyelet with the tattoos.
We hope you were inspired by this episode.
Until next week, that's it from me, Elisa.
And me, Lily.
If you agree that facades separate us and being radically honest brings us together, help spread the movement for radical self-acceptance by sharing this episode and subscribing to our podcast.
You can also watch our videos by subscribing to our YouTube channel and following us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @StyleAQ.
That's the letter U instead of the word U.
And check out our book, True Style is What's Underneath, The Self-Acceptance Revolution, on Amazon or at a local bookstore near you.
We can't skip ahead to a happy ending or live inside a Photoshopped image or an Instagram filter. There's no finding oneself when glossing over the truth.